from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today we'll revisit my interview with Art Prize-winning artist Anila Aga. Her award-winning work, Intersections, is finally coming to Indianapolis and will be on exhibit at the Indiana State Museum.
I'll find out about the Indianapolis Opera's American premiere of Jonathan Dove's opera based on Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
The annual Art Prize competition held in Grand Rapids, Michigan, featured more than 1,500 artist entries from around the world, competing for over $500,000 in prize money. In 2014, Indianapolis' own Anila Aga won the People's Choice Award and tied to win the Juried Award, first time that the same artist took home both the top prizes, making art world history. And now her winning piece, Intersections, is finally going to be shown in Indianapolis with an exhibit opening on March 19th at the Indiana State Museum. To celebrate this, we decided to revisit Travis DiNicola's extended interview with Anila from a year ago.
Anila, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Travis.
It's
my pleasure.
You're very welcome. I am so excited to have you here. I got to just first off say congratulations to you for winning. The biggest art prize ever. And what I mean by that is the art prize is really an incredible event that's put on in the city of Grand Rapids each year. This past fall was the sixth year for it. It takes place at the end of September, beginning of October. And each year they have literally thousands of artists submitting their work, including their work, showing their work, all over the city of Grand Rapids, in places where people can see the work for free, whether it's outdoors or indoors, in galleries and museums, in created spaces, in coffee shops and pizzerias, in hotels. And Grand Rapids Art Prize has an element to it that's really kind of fun in that people get to vote for what their favorite artwork is. And mm-hmm. It's all types of artwork. I mean, sculpture and performance and painting and drawing and photographs and such. And there's huge prizes, which we'll talk about, that are given away, both for the popular vote as well as for the juried vote. And I was fortunate enough to – I've been able to attend Art Prize the past few years, taking a group from the Indianapolis Museum of Arts Contemporary Art Society up there. And when we were up there last October, one of the pieces all of us, of course, wanted to see was yours, which was on display at and still is on display at the Grand Rapids Art Museum as part of Art Prize. And as soon as I saw it, I'm like, I can't wait to have Anila on the show to talk about it. And at that point, I didn't even know you were going to win. I mean, of course, we were hoping. But anyway, so was that a fair sort of condensed explanation of what
Very
Art Prize
good.
Is?
Yes. Excellent.
Well, thank you. So your piece did something that no other piece has done before. I mean, first off, Art Prize is the biggest art competition like this in the world with the biggest prizes. Mm-hmm. And this year they were giving out two top prizes. One was a $200,000 prize for the juried vote, and the other was a $200,000 prize for the popular vote. Mm-hmm. And you essentially won both. I mean, you won popular and split juried, right?
Yes,
and
I did.
A $300,000 prize, Anila, that's awesome.
Thank you very much.
I mean,
that's quite nice.
It is quite nice. We'll talk about that, too, in a minute, too. But let's talk about your work first. I mean, this was the first time you had competed in Art Prize, right? Mm-hmm. And how did you hear about it, or what made you decide to want to be a part of it?
Kevin Beist is, I think, the director of Art Prize, and he came here to do a lecture at the IDADA event some 4 years ago.
Okay.
So that's how I found out about it, and I thought it was a really interesting idea to do that. And so I thought I should, you know, look into it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as time goes by, you kind of think of things that you could send in, and then other things get in the way. So I was delayed in competing in it last year. And so I was determined to do it this year.
Mm-hmm. And in the past, I should say, I mean, other local artists, Quincy Owens, Kyle Ragsdale, other artists have been a part of mm-hmm. it as well in the past. So this was your first year competing.
Mm-hmm.
The piece that you created, and the title of it is Intersections.
Mm-hmm.
Had you created that before, or did you create it specifically for Art Prize?
Oh, no. This was something I had intended to do. You know, I got a really nice grant from Indiana University
mm-hmm.
called New Frontiers. And what it does is that it allows for an artist or, you know, school of, you know, anybody who's in the arts and humanities to try something that they haven't done in their practice before.
Okay.
So I decided to go this route because I was very interested in creating a space that would be almost considered a sublime space where people could walk in and feel like they belonged.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an intent that, and the grant that I received was in 2012.
Okay.
And it took me 15 months to create the piece. And then once it was done, I started sending out applications to you know, and proposals to show it in different parts of the country and
okay.
internationally, too. And so this was the first thing. Actually, earlier this year, I had submitted it into another competition.
Mm-hmm.
And it did go viral earlier this year, but I didn't win anything then.
Mm.
And so I was like, okay, you know, I have to keep trying. Otherwise, you
yeah.
know, I mean, all artists know how to deal with rejection, I think. So that was something I just toss it in a box and say, okay, I'll move on to the next one.
Well,
and then I applied for mm-hmm. Art Prize and I got in and I was very happy.
Well, let's talk about the piece itself. It is quite a large scale. I mean, I've
mm-hmm.
seen your work in other situations. You do often deal with light and shadows, but this was a whole room, a whole space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's centered around an enormous cube. Describe
mm-hmm.
that to me.
It's a laser-cut, black lacquered cube that was constructed out of wood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a single light source inside the cube itself. So it casts shadows outside all around it, top, bottom, sides.
And the cube itself is about how big? Is it?
It's about 6.5 feet square.
6.5 mm-hmm. feet square. And the patterns that are cut into this wood lacquer, tell me about them.
I visited the Alhambra in southern Spain some 3 years ago, and I was very fascinated by the Alhambra Palace, which is, you know, just an amazing jewel of architecture, design, art, everything. And when I was there, I was walking around and looking at the way people were interacting with that space,
mm-hmm.
and it fascinated me. And I've always strived in my own practice to deal with this idea of poetry or something, to create something poetic. And so this was like, I took about 1,000 photos. I came back home. I started doing some hand cutting. I was really fascinated. And I've always been fascinated by shadows, how they're cast, what direction they're cast. And so once I started looking at the photos and, you know, starting to think about what I wanted to create with this, it became all about the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the original and not the original. So, you know, our bodies are the original and then we cast shadows that are not the original. So that's something that always fascinates me. It's also dealing with the idea of post-colonial culture now. And so what is authentic and what is not authentic? You know, and how people appropriate from different places. So a lot of design comes from other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then we make it our own.
Are any of the, I mean, patterns that are in the cube traditional Islamic? Or are these directly from what you saw in Spain? Or
they are,
I mean, sort of variations on that?
They are variations
yeah.
on that. Because what I did was, once I started looking at the photos, and just to explain a little bit about the Alhambra Palace,
mm-hmm.
it's composed of wooden carvings as well as tile work, as well as, the ceilings are all carved, painted, frescoed. It's just like an amalgamation of art, delight. And so I decided to take parts and segments from different parts of the space.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can imagine a palace the size of the Metropolitan Museum, you know, and then picking out different
elements
motifs
that
I liked, and then I combined it together into a single pattern.
Okay.
And so it is appropriated from the Alhambra, but the ultimate design became my own.
Because it feels very sacred, but yet it's not quite identifiable. And I have to describe, I mean, the experience of walking into this gallery at the Grand Rapids Art Museum, you walk in and this cube, as you said, about 6.5 foot cube, made out of lacquered wood, is hanging suspended in the middle of the room. And it's almost like it's floating in the air. And then you've got this incredibly bright light that's hanging in the very center of it, that's casting shadows across the entire room, the floor, the ceiling, and so that the whole room becomes part of the art. And what's really amazing is the way that the shadows sort of hit the corners almost perfectly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as you walk in, it was an incredible effect, because as people would walk in the room, you could hear them get quieter in the way they spoke, almost as if they were entering some sort of sacred space. It was a really physical experience for the viewer to walk in there and to experience that. I got to ask, how bright is that light in the middle of the cube? Because it's stunningly bright, it seems.
It's about 600 watts.
Wow. And it really, I mean, the shadows that it casts are long and clear and so defined.
Mm-hmm. Like, if you notice, the ceiling and the floor had the most clarity because they were closer. And then the walls, because the space itself was about 44-foot square space.
Yeah.
The shadows became a little as they
just
went further
diffused.
Away. Yeah. And so that was also the beauty of it. Like something that's closer to you and is more, you know, about you is clear to you. But things that are not so clear of usually the things that we fear. And so that was also part of why I wanted to do this, to create the space where people become anonymous in a sense, but they're also immersed in this whole entire piece. So
well,
they become part of the art.
Right, because the shadows are being cast on them. Mm-hmm. And in fact, and then their bodies cast shadows as well. So so it changes all the time. And I'm not sure if I can describe this well, but the entrance is sort of a cut opening, a large entrance space into the gallery. But there's a wall right behind that. And so what happens with the shadow is, even though it's projected fairly clearly on all the walls in the gallery, at the entrance, the shadow, of course, keeps going and then is projected on the sort of farther wall that's kind of, blocking the entrance. And you get a sense that this piece could just keep going on forever.
Yes.
Another thing I really liked about it was that, and this was mentioned to me, I was there with Carter Wolf on the trip. And Carter, of course, used to be the director of the Art Center of Indianapolis, Indianapolis Art Center. And he mentioned how you could really only look at the piece directly if you were in one of the corners where enough of the corner of the construction was sort of blocking the light so that you could stare at it directly, because otherwise it was almost too bright to look at directly. And that also became sort of an interesting experience.
Well, also, like, if we think about the sun how it's a single light source, but it's so bright that it casts all this beautiful light on us and it keeps us alive on this earth. And then, but it's a single light source.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also very interesting to me, to think about how the world religions are always talking about, a single God. But everybody's God is a little different or the iteration is a little different. And so I wanted to bring everybody together to not think about that particularly. So when you ask me whether the patterns are Islamic in nature, they come from, every child that grows up in the Islamic world is familiar with these patterns because, in the Islamic world, you're not allowed to make human figures and stuff.
Sure.
So they started to do a lot of the geometrical stuff, which in itself becomes so beautiful. So in a sense, it's the same idea as Christianity where, the lived experience is not something to be very happy about. In Islam, it's kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You want to rise above the lived experience. And that in itself is also very interesting to me, that how can we be in a space or in a place in our heads and follow a religion that doesn't allow for the lived experience to be part of it.
We'll take a break here for just a moment to remind you that you're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI. Travis DiNicola has been chatting with Anila Aga, Heron Art Professor and winner of the 2014 Art Prize competition. We'll now return to the second part of this interview.
Complicated thought and complicated piece. And yet, mm-hmm. On one level, the piece is very sort of simple.
Yes.
But yet, obviously it had an enormous amount of appeal for so many people, mm-hmm. To win both the popular and the juried vote. What do you think? I know you talked to a lot of people who saw and experienced mm-hmm. the piece. What were you hearing as far as why it appealed to so many people? There were more than 1,500 works of art on exhibit this year at Art Prize competing mm-hmm. for the prizes. Why do you think yours stood out?
I think, in my opinion,
yeah.
I think that it was because it sort of seemed luminous and hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
And, with all the wars that we have witnessed in the last 5-6 years and also the natural disasters that have affected the world, people are looking for something to brighten their day or look towards hopeful future. And also the economy that took such a bad dip here in the United States and elsewhere in the world. I think everybody is looking to see something that would point towards a more hopeful future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing about art. It can raise you above yourself, and you can kind of reach a common goal. And I think that maybe this piece was able to do that in people's minds, because it was intensely beautiful, but it's also intensely poetic.
Anila, let's talk a little bit about your experience at Art Prize as well. Mm-hmm. All the artists that submit work, they have to essentially find a space that's willing mm-hmm. to show them. And certainly the most coveted spaces include the Grand Rapids Art Museum, because mm-hmm. it's just such a great space. And even though Art Prize as a whole isn't curated, individual spaces can curate what they mm-hmm. show. And, of course, the Grand Rapids Art Museum wants to show the best of the best. So when did you find out that you were going to be able to exhibit this installation at the Grand Rapids Art Museum?
Did
that affect your work at all?
I would think totally, because, that was obviously my first choice.
Yeah.
I looked at the spaces, I did my research, and then I knew what my minimum requirement was for the space, and mm-hmm. it had to be about 30 foot square.
Sure.
Or 30 by 40 or whatever. But, mm-hmm. it needed to be at least minimum 30. And so when I sent in the request, I sent it to a bunch of different places. I mm-hmm. sent it to the DeVos building, I think. I sent it to a couple of churches.
Sure.
I sent it to the Graham. And then some other people contacted me about it. But when I looked at their spaces, I was like, this is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And there may have been an occasion where I could have decided that, the space that I'm being given is not large enough to show it to advantage, and I may not have done it. But I was extremely lucky. Right away, 2 weeks into the thing, I got an email from the curator at Graham.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Cindy Buckner.
And Graham is the Grand Rapids Art Museum, yeah.
And she was lovely about it, and she asked me some very pertinent questions, and mm-hmm. she asked me what my intent was or my artist statement. And she sent me a small paragraph about her curatorial idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is tailor-made for this
piece. That's
awesome. It was just like somebody had written that paragraph for this mm-hmm. piece. It was about, how we can get out of our comfort zones and, experience something that's not so comfortable.
That's very fortunate that you were able to be there. Because, that was really, I went to a lot of the different mm-hmm. installation spaces and gallery spaces. And really, the only one I can even imagine it in is at the Graham.
Mm-hmm.
So during Art Prize, it's a 3-week-long event. Were you up there for a lot of it? For some of it, you were, of course, still teaching your classes here at Heron. So I imagine you couldn't be up there the whole time.
No. I made it up for 3 weekends mm-hmm. and 1 full week.
Okay.
And so that was really, really quite nice. The preview stuff started happening before it even went live.
Yeah.
And so I went up for that a few times. But it was pretty hectic because I could only take a week off.
Mm-hmm.
And, I care about my students. I didn't really want to be gone for so long that they
sure.
would suffer. And so it became a very balancing act.
I bet you're busy.
And then writing to them and telling them, you know, okay, you need to do this, this, and this while I'm doing that, you know, at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. It was just, but the experience was pretty amazing.
Well, even from the very beginning, you were getting some great reviews from people up in Grand Rapids, both professional journalists as well as just people attending Art Prize about, you know, you got to go see this piece. I mean, that had to be pretty exciting.
It was very exciting, but I was still, you know, I'm a very stoic person in real life. I just think that, you know, when things happen, they happen. You just have to deal with them and, you know, move on. And so even when people were saying all those and I was reading different reviews, I was like thinking, keep calm, you know, nothing may happen, but at least you got the best opportunity to show this piece at this awesome, amazing museum. And so I was quite happy to just be able to do that.
Well, and then throughout the process, they do narrow it down to the first group that gets the highest votes and finalists and all that stuff. So you knew that you were progressing. At what point did you really think, man, I have a chance that I could actually win this? When they announced your name?
Like I said, I didn't want to go there because the disappointment would have been too intense. And so, you know, they asked me on the day that I was coming in for the awards night. I was driving in, and it takes about 4.5-5 hours to drive. And so they Sia, one of the young women who's with the PR department at Graham, she asked me if I could write my acceptance speech, like 3 or 4 sentences. And I'm like, I don't know how to do this. But then I wrote her, like, you know, just thank yous to everybody who had helped me and get along on the way. And so I sent it to her. And that was probably the time when I really thought about it.
This could happen.
Yeah.
So, but it still had to be a huge surprise when you found out that you won the popular vote and one part of the juried vote. I mean, to get both is such an incredible compliment because
it is.
I mean, it's
amazing.
Both your peers and the public. I mean, that's huge.
That is wonderful. And like somebody asked me earlier a few weeks ago about which one was more important to me. I think I can't really pick between the two because, you know, to be able to reach across to the popular or the people at large is like an amazing feat. And often not many artists are able to do that.
Right.
You know, so, but then to be acknowledged by your peers and by the art professionals of the world kind of elevates, you know, what I've been doing and authenticates it, validates it. And so I can't pick. It's like a total balanced.
Well, and in the past with the Art Prize, there's been a lot of division, I would say, between, I mean, originally it was just a public vote, and then they added the juried part of it. And even with that, there's been a lot of division between what the jury liked and what the public liked. And there's been some beautiful pieces that the public have liked, but also some pieces people have really questioned, you know, about the quality of the art in the past. And so, I mean, it is kind of amazing that, you know, this is the first time that essentially everybody agreed.
I mean, like, wow, it was quite an honor. I mean, that's all I can say. I mean, I couldn't have imagined.
Does this change your career? Or
I think it's a game changer, definitely. It's.
I mean, you're still going to keep teaching at Heron.
I hope so. If they'll have me. But yeah, it's sort of like it validates what you've been doing all along. And for the last 15, 20 years, I've been making art. And so I'm just happy that it's been acknowledged on such a public forum. I think the magnitude is immense. And so that's what's amazing. I'm still getting emails. I'm still getting people writing about it. And so,
and not just regionally, but I mean across the country and across the world. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm getting like requests from like places like Korea and China. I actually did do an interview for an online blog that's called Art Radar that's based out of China, Armenia, you know, like Turkey.
Well, you know, I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that in many ways, I mean, what you created is one of the most important artworks created in this past year by anybody.
And thank you.
That's it's a really cool, amazing thing. You know, so so I got to ask you, you know, 300,000, that's nothing to sneeze at. plans for that?
Well, I'm going to take, hopefully, my sabbatical next year. Mm-hmm. So it's going to pay for that.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to make some more work next year. So my intent is to put it back into the to my art practice and generate more work.
That's awesome. Do you think you'll try to compete in Art Prize again or take some time off from that maybe?
I think I may step back and reevaluate what I, you know, because Art Prize is it's an amazingly wonderful event, but it's also intensely competitive and very stressful.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
I mean, like knowing that you're participating and then everybody wants to talk to you or, you know, and then there's some...
I mean, that's a very type of different experience of what most artists have.
We live a very solitary life, you know. We live in our studios, and it's hard to be constantly on the, you know, on the go, talking to people. I was happy to talk to people, but I'm also a very shy person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people don't believe that, but I am.
Well, Anila, I just have to say again, congratulations on winning Art Prize and on creating such a stunning and important work. I know that the piece is still on exhibit right now at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. What are the future plans for the piece? Can you share any of that with us?
I have a couple of inquiries about showing it in different two locations right now. One is in Texas and one is in California. And so I'm kind of discussing it with them right now. Nothing concrete yet. And then I have also had some requests for acquiring it. So that's the other thing that I'm kind of working through. And then currently I'm building another smaller piece for an exhibition in the Middle East.
Wow. Okay.
That's going to be in stainless steel. So that's and actually I went back to Grand Rapids to get it cut so that I'm giving them back some of the money.
Oh, that's really great. Yeah. That's awesome that you're
able
to do that.
We thought that it would be appropriate.
Well, I really hope that in some form Intersections gets to be exhibited here in Indianapolis someday.
It would
be wonderful.
So
that we can all see it. That would be terrific. Listen up, gallery and museum directors. most important piece to come out of Indianapolis ever. Show it now. Anila, again, congratulations. And thank you so much for coming in on Art of the Matter today.
I really appreciate it. And thank you for letting me ramble on.
Travis DiNicola with artist Anila Aga, who won the 2014 Art Prize competition. Anila is also an associate professor of drawing at the Heron School of Art and Design. This interview is a rebroadcast from a year ago. Anila's work, Intersections, is finally going to be exhibited in Indianapolis with an exhibit opening on March 19th at the Indiana State Museum as part of their 200 Years Art Exhibition of Indiana Artists. For more information about Art Prize, visit artprize.org. For more information about Anila, visit anilaaga.squarespace.com, anilaaga.squarespace.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know, March, many years, seems like it doesn't have a lot of holidays, but we have two. On the horizon.
That's right.
The Ides of March and St. Patrick's Day.
And Easter is in March this month,
and
too.
Easter is in March this month.
They're just packing them in this month.
Indeed. So we have some arts events that people can go out and do to celebrate any and all of the above on that calendar we call
What do we do?
What do you have?
Okay. Hey, we just replayed my interview with Anila Aga and mentioned that her piece is going to be featured as part of the Indiana State Museum's 200 Years exhibition. That's a really cool exhibition that I just wanted to talk about briefly to look at some other things that Mark Rushman, who's the curator there, has put together. Basically, there's going to be over 100 different artworks of Indiana artists representing 200 years of Indiana art. And so, of course, you're going to have some great stuff by T.C. Steele and other artists from the Hoosier Group. You're also going to have, though, artists like Robert Indiana and George Rickey featured, and a whole bunch of other artists. Some names you may recognize, some names you may not, but older works through contemporary works. And again, sort of the big featured piece is Anila Aga's Art Prize winning piece. So this is very cool. And again, it opens on the 19th, it runs through October 2nd. They're doing a big opening reception party on the 18th that you can still get tickets for as well. I'm looking forward to this. 200 years of Indiana art, a cultural legacy. Should be a great exhibit at the State Museum?
I don't actually recall any recent art exhibit that leads you through chronologically like that. So that'll be a great education.
I think that'll be very cool.
Yeah,
yeah,
love
to see
it.
Sort of how our art has evolved.
Love it. So this is a story set in 19th century Italy. It concerns a young soldier and the changes that are brought about in this young man by the obsessive love of his colonel's homely ailing cousin. So a love story, but also, if those of you who know Stephen Sondheim recognized Passion, a beautiful, luscious musical with difficult and super effective music, not difficult to listen to, difficult to perform. That's on stage right now at Theater on the Square. So Sondheim, if it's been a while since you've had your Sondheim fix, go see Passion at Theater on the Square. More information at tots.org.
Lots of Irish celebrations coming up, of course, with St. Paddy's Day, including the 146th annual Ancient Order of the Hibernian St. Patrick's celebration. That's on March 13th on Sunday. All ages starts with a mass at St. John's at 10 o'clock. Don't forget to set your clocks ahead. And then you can parade to the Indiana Roof at 11:30. The program begins at noon with a lunch served, stories and songs by Mossy Moran from the southeast coast of Ireland. And you can win a trip to Ireland and all sorts of other great things. So that's the big Hibernian celebration on March 13th at the Indiana Roof. And then afterwards, there's also a fundraiser at Holy Cross Church, St. Patrick's fundraiser. And then, of course, next week, we've got the greening of the canal on the 16th, and then the St. Paddy's Day party on the 17th for St. Patrick's Day for the parade, and then lots of other events going on there. And then on the 19th, the official Shamrock Run through Irish Hill with a party on the Circle. It's just nonstop. Actually, if you want to go to one place where they have all of this listed, check out Indy Irish Fest. The Irish Fest isn't actually until September, but they are helping to organize and promote all the events around St. Paddy's Day going on right now.
Love it. Very good. One more chance for Irish music this weekend. If you're hearing us on Thursday afternoon, you have the chance to go Friday night at 7:30 to Avon Middle School North Auditorium. Pay attention, there are two Avon Middle Schools. This is Avon Middle School North. That concert's at 7:30. Also on Sunday at 3 o'clock, same location. Who are you hearing? You're hearing the Hendrix Symphonic Society in a concert celebrating St. Patrick's Day. They'll be joined by the Hendrix Symphonic Choir, Irish choral music dancers, and instrumentalists. I had a chance to see this concert last year, and it's high energy and a lot of fun. Great way to celebrate St. Patrick's Day, whether you're Irish or not.
Very cool. Hey, Newsies is coming to Clues Memorial Hall. I know everyone's so excited about this. If you don't know what I'm talking about, there's the 1992 film, and you can get that on DVD or I'm sure Netflix or whatever. Great fun, very cool film that was turned into a musical a few years back and won some Tonys and now is touring. And so Newsies is coming to Clues March 15th. Through the 20th, and basically it's about the newspaper boy strike of 1899, when a whole bunch of orphans who were newsies took a strike against Pulitzer and Hearst and the other powerful newspaper organizations. Lots of fun dancing, lots of great music, very cool sets and costumes. Should be a lot of fun for everyone in the whole family. Newsies.
The ISO has your ticket for this weekend, including Richard Strauss's magnificent tone poem Don Quixote, music of Manuel de Falla and Alberto Ginastera, Spanish Passion. Find out more at IndianapolisSymphony.org.
You know, this is the last weekend for the Orchid Show at the
IMA. Oh, I'm sad.
I know. It was such a beautiful, beautiful show in the pop-up shop and going out to the gardens and checking the greenhouse, which is fantastic. So I encourage you to do that if you haven't done that yet. But also, Garfield Park has some great things going on at their conservatory and gardens, including the Gnome and Fairy House Workshop coming March 19th.
Wait.
Gnome and Fairy House. They are.
Is this for both gnomes and fairies, or is one workshop for gnomes and the others
for? They're doing for both. They're celebrating their Gnome Away from Home show, which is going on, where they're going to have gnomes throughout the conservatory. So, and as part of that, you can make small gnome and fairy. Gnome and fairy houses are very different, Sharon. So it's one workshop.
I think so. They're completely different scales. So it's like an N gauge and an O gauge.
They're nicely done, yeah, with trains. So, and you can learn how to make small gnome and fairy houses and figures out of natural objects. Registration is required. It's from 11 till noon on the 19th. And they're just going to have gnomes. Because these gnomes have come from all over the world to gather at the conservatory for their vacation. Gnome away from home.
And now for something completely different. Wild carrot. No, it's not something you eat. It's not even a hip new restaurant. It is a band that is coming here on March 19th as part of the Indie Folk Series. No, I didn't just accidentally say series twice. Contemporary folk rooted in tradition, award-winning original songs featuring guitar, mandolin, dulcimer, concertina, and maybe more. Wild Carrot, Indie Folk Series, Saturday, March 19th.
And you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis' Indie Arts Guide website. Or listen to us next weekend on the calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Next week, the Indianapolis Opera is producing the U.S. premiere of Jonathan Dove's opera based on Jane Austen's Mansfield Park. Sharon Gamble invited General Director Kevin Patterson to our studios to learn about this accessible and romantic work.
Tell us the story of how this company got to become the American company to premiere Mansfield Park.
Well, I have had a long association with the English composer Jonathan Dove. Mm-hmm. Jonathan had composed this opera in 2011 for the Heritage Opera Society over in the UK. And it was originally conceived to be done in those grand English staterooms that you see in these manor houses. So those of you who are Downton Abbey fans,
right,
you know, you might see this in the Grand Salon. And so it was conceived to be done with a four-hand piano.
Okay.
So there's no orchestra, no traditional orchestra for this, because most of these English manor homes probably didn't have orchestra pits.
Right.
So he composed this piece, and it was premiered in 2011. It was done in a number of different houses, and later became a way for the Heritage Society of England to raise money for the preservation of these, some of these English manor homes, because they find their way back into the government, the state, and then they have to be kept up. So this was a great opportunity for that as well. And then I started working with Jonathan in the mid-2000s. I did his first opera called Flight, which is based on the life of Mehran Karimi Nasseri, who was an Iranian who was trapped in Charles de Gaulle Airport and lived there for 18 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And so he wrote this piece. The American premiere was in 2004 at Opera Theater of St. Louis. I went on to do Flight twice, once in Pittsburgh Opera in 2006, I think, and then again in 2011 in Austin, Texas.
What a great setup for storyline.
It is a great setup for a storyline. And so with Mansfield Park, we have another fabulous story. I mean, we have Jane Austen, probably one of the most celebrated authors of the time. Those of you who are into Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, you'll like the latest that has come out here in the movie theaters. But for those of you who like Jane Austen in a little more pure form.
Pure Jane Austen.
No zombies in Mansfield Park. But a great story. And I think Jonathan and the librettist Alistair Middleton do a really great job bringing down this expansive novel and making it into an opera. And it's two acts. It's about 120 minutes, two acts, nine characters. It is all the characters that you find in a typical in the novel Mansfield Park. And the story, a little bit condensed. Some of the subplots are a little, you know, are not there.
Mm-hmm.
But in essence, it is the same story of Fanny and her going to live with the Bertrams and not fitting in and the love interests and all of that that play out.
So tell for people who are not familiar with Jonathan's style, tell us about his musical style.
Jonathan's musical style is a musical style that is very neo-romantic. It's very tuneful. It's rhythmic. But it is a style that you will come out of the hall singing some of the tunes in the show. It is very thorough composed, so it's not like a traditional, say, Barber Seville, where you've got an aria and then stop and then you've got some recit. This is sung entirely through.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, and I mean this in the best of intents, his scores are almost Broadway-esque in that the action never really stops. And he keeps it moving and flowing.
So
and
he's really driving the
he's
story.
He's really driving the narrative. Uh-huh. And it makes it easy for the audience to be able to follow along and feel comfortable existing in this musical world.
Kind of a silly question, but I have to ask. So it's a British novel? British accents?
British accents. We have a diction coach that's come in to work with all of the artists. And we're very much paying attention to the whole Regency period, not only just in clothing, but in the furniture and in the style of the period. We really, you know, with Downton Abbey being out, which is later, which is Edwardian, we're mm-hmm. moving earlier into Regency.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't want to mash up these things. I mean, it's very easy, I think, for companies sometimes to say, well, we're going to do English, and they just sort of throw it out there.
They kind of pick a period.
Yeah,
throw a dart at a calendar somewhere before the 20th century.
Yeah, and so we've said, you know what, we really want to be faithful to Jane Austen. We want to be faithful to the story. And so English accents in the very much the Regency period.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that audiences will step back in time with this a little bit.
But I'm going to reference Downton because we've been referencing Downton Abbey. Very much still a caste system, even more so than the Downton Abbey period.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, at the very beginning of Mansfield Park, the opening number, you have all of the characters in one way or another introducing themselves. And at the very beginning, you have Lady Bertram, and Lady Bertram is obsessed with her pug. And we'll have a real pug on stage.
Oh.
We are collaborating with the Kentucky Anna Pug Rescue.
Really?
And so we're reaching out with them to bring a pug to the stage. We'll have a star.
Okay, now wait. I have to ask. When there are children involved, you have to use twins so that anyone is not mm-hmm. on stage too long. Do you have to have two pugs, or will one pug be able to?
I think probably one pug will be able to do it, but we may have to have a pug standby. We'll see. We'll see kind of what we've got. And we haven't met our pug yet, but we're in the process of making that happen. But it's a great opportunity to bring in a collaborative partner, something
sure.
non-traditional. I mean, most opera companies don't collaborate with animal rescue shelters, but
no.
But we think, you know, it's important. It's another storyline that we can bring in. But, you know, Lady Bertram is all obsessed with her pug. The other Bertram children, you know, is saying that she's not marrying a man. She's marrying $10,000 a year. She's marrying a salary. And, you know, the other kids and Lord Bertram and what he's doing. And so, in a way, I think what makes Jane Austen hold up so well for modern audiences is that, especially in our day and time where, you know, we're arguing about income inequality and the haves and the have-nots,
mm-hmm.
I think people can see this story and see the love story that's Fanny Price and discovering love and navigating this world that she's in, but also to see sort of the disparity that's going on and the turf wars that happen within the family over what's going on.
And that makes such rich ground for opera.
Oh, it does. It makes phenomenally rich ground. It gives us wonderful jumping off points for arias. It's very much, Mansfield Park is very much an ensemble piece,
mm-hmm.
almost like Mozart's Così fan tutte or La Nozze di Figaro. So no character can sort of hide against the wall and be under the radar. Everybody is pulling their own. It's a fabulous piece because it's such a great libretto that Alistair's put together for actors. You're really getting the best of both worlds in this opera.
And I want to talk about Karen Carpenter in just a moment, but you're also, that also means that everybody has to be in good voice and on.
Yes.
Pretty much all the time.
Yes. And it's a little bit,
no place
you know,
to hide.
Unlike a piece like Lucia de Lammermoor, where you've got it star driven and you've got that supporting cast.
Mm-hmm.
For me, whenever I go to cast these pieces, you know, you never get to assemble the whole cast in the room and sort of try them out before you cast them.
Right.
So you get to that first music rehearsal and you listen and go, how'd I do? Did I get – is one voice a lot stronger than another? Are the timbres and the Czech textures and there's enough differentiation? So there's a little bit of a gamble in that when you do these ensemble pieces and with nine people – that have to be able to interrelate with each other musically and have the audience follow along with them. It's a challenge, but it's a wonderful thing to do.
How fun. And of course, those instruments still can be tuned. People can accommodate one another.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's talk about the staging of this and the stage direction of this.
So the staging for this, Karen Carpenter is our stage director. I reached out to Karen when we first thought about doing this piece because I felt that it was very important to have a director who had a good theatrical grounding in being able to tell a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we think about a lot of opera, the librettos are almost nonsensical. And it's hard, you know, if you've ever sat through a performance of Trovatore, Verdi's Trovatore, it's got all the great music in it, but we like to say that all of the great action happens in the intermission, and we don't see it, because we all stand around talking about it in the next act.
It's all offstage.
But for Mansfield Park, the narrative is driving that story, and you've got to have a director who can shape that narrative and bring out and highlight the parts. In addition to, you know, not to say this too flippantly, but to be a traffic cop managing nine people moving around on stage at any given time.
Right.
The other big issue with Mansfield Park is that because it moves from location to location to location, you obviously on a stage, unlike, say, in a movie or a television series, you can't quickly move from locale to locale
right.
to locale. So the worst thing you can do is overproduce the piece. So we have to find a simplified set that can work for many of the different locations and then, again, let that narrative drive us
along
the way.
So you're not having to change out, bringing in different furniture or anything like that?
There's very little time in this opera.
Sure.
There's not a lot of moments where Jonathan has composed change the furniture music
right,
or
right.
change the scenery music. So it has to flow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for modern audiences, you know, we're used to that in cinema, the action just moving.
Right.
And even on Broadway, I mean, the worst thing you can do is stop the action and change the scenery and everybody sit around.
Right.
So we're now with our audiences seeing this constant movement. And Karen does a really, really great job with this. She's the artistic director of the William Inge Theater Festival, which is a 35-year-old festival. And she, you know, she had done Della and Nora Ephron's Love and Loss and What I Wore, which is a great piece. So we're really bringing her creativity and her directing sensibilities to the show.
Mm-hmm. For anybody who's like, ooh, contemporary composer, I'm a little scared. Give us some words of encouragement.
Well, I would go back and say that, you know, Jonathan's music is extremely accessible.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about when you go to the movies and you hear film scores,
mm-hmm.
his music is as accessible musically as a film score or to a score to a Broadway show that you might be seeing, with maybe the exception of Hamilton, which is, you know, a little different,
yeah.
But still very accessible. But he's extremely accessible. The story you're going to know if you're a Jane Austen fan or you've tuned into the BBC series or seen I think that was 87 film version of Mansfield Park that came out. You're going to know the story. You're going to be able to identify with these characters. So we're creating an environment for you where coming in, even though you don't know the composer and you may not think, oh, that contemporary opera, you needn't be scared or worried because you're going to walk into an environment that you're going to feel very comfortable with right out of the gate.
Related question. You're here. You're really settled now. What have you learned about Indianapolis audiences? Or what have you learned anew because you're from here?
Sure. I think the most interesting thing that we have learned this year is that audiences are excited to experience new things. They don't want the same old, same old. And we're seeing this not only in Indianapolis, but, you know, in the last, I'd say, 7 or 8 years as I've traveled across the United States doing opera in other places, while there will always be a place in operatic audiences' hearts for the chestnuts, for the butterflies and the bohems and the things like that, we have a generation that of opera goers that now can access so much art digitally. That now what really deepens the experience for the audience is to give them an experience that they can't go out and get anywhere else.
Ah.
And they're very interested with the man who mistook his wife for a hat in August. It was a brand new theater for our audience. Mm-hmm. It was a piece that they hadn't seen before. Though they may have known Michael Nyman in the film score for the movie The Piano, they still, you know, came in. But they walked out of the theater going, wow, I've never experienced opera this way, and I didn't know that opera could do this. And so we're reshaping people's expectations. We're moving beyond what they think the art form is. And we're finding that audiences are like, yeah, I can do this. I can go with this.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Opera's General Director Kevin Patterson. Contemporary composer Jonathan Dove wrote the music, and contemporary librettist Alistair Middleton wrote the words for Mansfield Park. The opera is receiving its U.S. premiere at the Schrott Center for the Arts March 18th through the 30th, and you can learn more and get tickets at indieopera.org. Again, indieopera.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll get a preview of this year's Butler Arts Fest.
And I'll get to meet pianist Jiyoung Jung.
And I'll find out about the new Before I Die Festival. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more. So please listen to The Art of the Matter next weekend here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.